Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening. And without further ado, the episode. I feel like they're having fun, you know? I'm having fun.
Okay. Hey, guys, welcome back to another episode of Hard Fried. We're having fun. How are you doing, Henry?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm hanging in there. Let's. Right on,
That's all you can do. That's all any of us can do, you know?
Yep. The listeners have came back for part two of FDR, so let's give them to them. I don't give them my problems, let's give them FDR's
problems. That is right. Last time we left off part one, FDR had just assumed the governorship of the state of New York. Today we're going to chronicle his first two terms of presidency, the highs and the lows, and just what was going on. Again, we're going to focus more on domestic occurrences, and then next episode we're gonna talk World War II, because I mean we kind of have to with this bad boy, right? So without further ado, Act One, testing the waters. March 1929, FDR asked the New York legislature. One of the first things he does is ask the legislature for authority to construct a series of hydroelectric dams along the St. Lawrence River and sell the power to private companies at cost. And he also moves to regulate existing utility companies. And he also shifts the tax burden from farmers to taxing gasoline purchases. So he's kind of heard the farmers, or, you know, as far as what's going on in Meriwether County, of what the farmers in Meriwether County, where his estate and resort is, he's listened to them, and now he's implementing something, not in Georgia, but trying something that he thinks would resonate with New York farmers, trying it where he can, you know?
Yeah.
He's using that money to build a series of, like, farm-to-market roads and also to build schools and provide electricity in New York.
Yeah.
Then, of course, on October 28th, 1929, Black Tuesday, the bottom falls out of the stock market. You have the onset of the Great Depression, and FDR has to respond, you know? October 1929 through May 1930, everyone is kind of unsure of what to make of the crash.
That was your description of Black Tuesday is probably the most succinct I've ever heard.
I don't understand it. I mean, I'm glad you think it's succinct, because I'm lost.
It's succinct. I don't understand, like, the financial mechanics of what happened. From my understanding, people, I don't fucking understand. I've watched a couple of TV series were based around it, but they never really fully explained.
Yeah, it's kind of economics is all made up. That's what they don't tell you. It's all
made up.
An elaborate lie that we all just.
You're right.
We just buy into it. You know, literally buy into this elaborate lie that there are rules, and it does kind of exist. But I've also heard, I don't know if it's Adam Smith or some economic dude or some philosopher. He was like, the invention of economics is, Like you basically open Pandora's box, and it's the invention of something that man thought he could understand and regulate, but was this whole other beast that's beyond comprehension.
It's the reason why when you get an economics, you get a bachelor. You get a bachelor. A lot of times, most of the times, you get a bachelor of arts.
that makes sense.
Science. It's like sociology or psychology. It has its flaws.
Yeah,
of course.
I guess what it was is it was all kind of like, what do you call anti-hype? What's the opposite of hype? What's bad hype? Anxiety, I guess. I don't know.
But hype is
like a general thing, you know? I'm trying to think of like, it's like a panic. You know, everybody hears that this is too good to be true. Everybody hears that something is about to happen. And so everybody races to the stock market to withdraw their money and divest their shares. But, you know, once a few people start doing that, then everybody starts doing that. And so all of a sudden you've got all of these companies who need to pay out dividends, I suppose, to people who are divesting, but they don't have that money. And so you've got all of these businesses that go bankrupt, and then this inevitably like spills over to the banks. And
I would argue that the hype is not really the hype is the problem or whatever, with the panic or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's more the problem of these banks over leveraging their funds and spending cash that they fucking don't have, or people fucking over, you know, it's a lot. All right.
But that's how they make their money, you know, is by these loans.
At a certain
and
point,
shit,
you can't, it's, you know.
You also got to have that cash on hand, man. If you don't have cash on hand,
you have to have a certain amount on hand. Uh-huh. So when people come for it, the banks just go, I don't have it.
Oh, shit, man.
I don't have.
I don't know what to tell you, bro. I kind of have this 6-month long term gambit I'm playing out, and I can't service your needs now. So it's like, okay. Cool.
Cool. Can't do that.
I don't know. Maybe it was FDR law. I don't remember reading about it, but like the idea of minimum reserves, like a bank must have X amount of cash on hand to prevent exactly this sort of thing.
That's I think the FDR thing.
Right. October 1929 to May 1930, again, everybody's unsure of what to make of the crash. Some people are thinking it might be temporary, like maybe this is just kind of a blip on the radar and things will bounce back to normal pretty quick. And then it's like, oh shit, never mind, we're in deep shit here, guys. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, you know? And so Democrats, they sense an opportunity to come back into power, because they've effectively been out of the White House, at least the White House, since Woodrow Wilson's presidency ended, you know, like a good decade or so since they've been in the White House. And so they're like, we can leverage this, you know what I mean? And so FDR, he's speaking out as governor. He's speaking out in favor of old age pensions and unemployment insurance. And he's up for, re-election in November of 1930 against the Republican candidate Charles H. Tuttle, who's like blasting him for his ties to Tammany, which just goes to show you he's kind of like changed the relationship and turn over a new leaf, because now FDR is like a Tammany boy. Not a Tammany boy, but he's friendly, because you kind of have to be, right? But FDR wins despite that.
It's New York politics. You're not going to win.
Yeah. You're not going to get shit done without these guys.
Yeah, you might be in Albany, but you got to fucking come down. You got to come down into the city.
Got to get to the boys, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
November 6th/7th, 1930, FDR wins re-election by the largest plurality won by any gubernatorial candidate in New York's history. I think that's up to that time. I don't know if that record is still standing. I wouldn't doubt it, however.
I have no idea. I do not know New York state politics.
I do not. So. It's not my area, you know?
No clue.
Very next day after his re-election, this guy James Farley announces that he did not see how Mr. Roosevelt can escape becoming the next presidential nominee of his party. And FDR publicly plays dumb, like, because you have to. You know, what are you talking? Me for president? No, I don't think so. While privately, like, giving the green light to James Farley and his boy, his slinker, Louis Howe. You know, he's like, we're doing this shit, guys. We're doing it, fellas. You know, fellas, right?
Yeah, if that political operative role is how probably set that shit up.
Yep. he's been waiting for this for years.
Yeah.
You know, he's ready to go, right? Ready for the
big
leagues.
How much money you make off of running a fucking campaign? Let's not talk about it right now.
I don't know how much you made in these times. I know nowadays it's very lucrative.
It's lucrative. It's always been lucrative.
It doesn't, it shouldn't be, but it is.
Yeah, you know? It is. Yeah.
August 28th of 1931, FDR calls the New York State Legislature into a special session and asks them to appropriate $20 million to provide useful work where possible, and where that was impossible, to provide the needy with food against starvation and with clothing and shelter against the suffering. To these unfortunate citizens, aid must be extended by government, not as a matter of charity, but as a matter of social duty.
And he's a communist.
And he's a communist. God damn you, sir. And then he's done. He's done. You know, no need to debate the merits of this idea at all. You've already understood it to the best of your ability. This is a communist. All communists are Stalin. We're all going to be in camps. We're all going to be killed. The Great Terror is going to be unleashed. And you don't bother. Don't worry about it. All right.
A bullet behind the ear for.
That's the best policy here. Okay?
You motherfuckers. Don't even, yeah, they, yeah. I mean, this would be considered, this would be considered a big deal if a president said this now.
Yeah, I know, right?
If a president's like, this is social duty.
This is so not, it's not charity. Down. It's literally what we should do as like a functioning kind of, quasi-utilitarian society, society that values utilitarianism. We should.
I don't know what that word utilitarian means.
Greatest good for the greatest number of people. I guess a democratic ideal. You know, there are issues with it, but I mean, for the most part, I feel like it's not a bad policy. You know, not a bad idea.
Oh no, I'm just the definition of utilitarian. I immediately go to a place, but that's my own.
I understand. I get that. African American. I get that. Yeah, there's pushback. There's pushback. Of course.
Yeah.
If you can abridge all that stuff, then it should work hypothetically. If you can remove all that stuff, but it's not like it's a therefore. You know, anything follows a therefore. You're kind of like, I don't know, man. The money that FDR asked for, the $20 million, is distributed by the Temporary Emergency Relief Administration, or TERRA. And then Louis Howe and James Farley are both like, they're kind of running his campaign, or starting to run his campaign for president in 1932. They're like tracking down delegates and you know, wheeling and dealing, right? And FDR is using Warm Springs, Georgia, as a base to meet with Southern Democrats and to see if he can get them on his side.
Yeah.
May 22nd, 1932, this is FDR's final speech before the nominating convention at Oglethorpe University in Georgia. He asks, hypothetically, or rhetorically rather, "Must the country remain hungry and jobless while raw materials stand unused and factories idle? The country needs, the country demands, bold, persistent experimentation. Take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another, but above all, try something."
Okay. All right. All right. I mean, a lot of people don't try.
A lot of people don't try. That's the thing.
He's saying something profound there. But I think so. I'm going to go. It just affected me personally. You know, I try a lot. I try.
Yeah.
I fail a lot.
Fail a lot.
I admit it frankly, and I continue to try again, but I've not won anything recently.
But nothing's worked yet, and I get so discouraged.
Yeah.
I get so sad.
I've tried some things, a lot of things.
Yep. You gotta, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again.
Yeah, but at the 20th
time. It doesn't
time,
tell you maybe, what to do after the first time. You know, if the second time you don't succeed. Where's the line? When does this become sunk cost, right?
Maybe the 20th time you kind of quit making beats.
Maybe.
You kind of quit producing and SoundCloud producing.
Yeah, maybe you take down that SoundCloud page, all right?
Never going to take it down.
Never keep it up as a fond reminder of the dreams that once were.
It's a reminder of what can be at any time. I'd say hop back in the game.
Mm. Right on. What's your SoundCloud, man? I wanna look you up. I wanna blow you up, man.
And moving on.
You don't wanna drop your SoundCloud, bro?
No.
Okay. All right.
No. No.
I wanna hear it. I'm down to hear it.
It's good music.
I'm sure more of our listeners would also like to hear this, the SoundCloud beeps, the smooth rhythms of Joshua B. Stokes.
June 27th of 1932. That's what.
June 27th of 1932. There's a convention in Chicago. FDR eventually wins. This is the nominating convention. So they did have, like, there were some issues with every nominating convention of, like, favorite sons popping up and trying, because FDR had, like, a majority, not a majority, he had close to the, I think it's two-thirds majority he needed in order to be confirmed. He's got close to that. And so there was the risk of, like, favorite sons from wherever, some fucking Kansas or some shit popping up and being like, I want to be president. And if they can forestall it long enough, then they can force a compromise candidate. Mm-hmm. But FDR eventually wins out. He flies to Chicago to accept the nomination. And flying is still, like, very dangerous at this time. It's only been, what, like, 30 years? I mean, it's not like the paper planes that you had in World War One.
Yeah, it's
still working out the kinks, though. You know, it's not. I would argue it is safer now. I'm pretty sure.
I mean,
I would wager.
It would be like, it would. It feels like it would be. It's like it's such a leap because, like, they were just doing paper planes like 30 years ago. Now they have.
All
compared to that,
do is pow, 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 then I'm gonna ching and
refuse
take
to even
money,
acknowledge that.
Right?
Don't say that too much because we'll get dinged for the for the song. All right.
Really? Oh, shit.
Wait, okay. No, wait. It's you speaking. Never mind. But from, like, 30 years to 1932, like, these are incredibly, like, a lot safer planes in comparison to the paper planes. But in comparison to now, no, they're death traps.
They're death traps. They're very rickety, very, like, rough stuff.
Yeah.
But he gets to the nominating convention to accept. And the fact that he's flying is like, he's committed to this. He's showing how serious he is about running for president. He feels like he has to be there, right? He can't be away, right? So during his acceptance speech, he announces that, quote, I pledge you, I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people.
Boom, boom, boom. That's where you drop it. Yeah,
right,
you
there
drop
he
that.
Is. Boom.
Where you the horn, DJ horn at.
Uh-huh.
There.
Summer of 1932, the Bonus Army, which is a group of World War One vets waiting on early payment of wartime bonuses due in 1945, they start camping along the Anacostia River, which runs kind of like northwest through D.C.
Yeah.
Police chief, I think it's the D.C. police chief, Pelham Glassford. What a name, right? Pelham Glassford?
Yeah. Oof.
He's a fucking nerd, dude. Pelham Glassford.
That's a. This family had the first car in whatever town they're from.
I bet so. Yeah, Pelham, the Glassfords, the Baltimore Glassfords. They're doing okay. You know, rest assured, they're fine.
Had a car in 1887, fam.
Mm-hmm. Before they were even commercially available. You know what I mean? Just like, we got the, we know the guy who made these.
Yeah, this is the second one of what? The car. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, his cousin did blow up in that model because it was an experimental model. So, although wealthy, they do still have their issues. But, you know, everybody does.
A lot of, you know what I mean?
Pour one out for Cousin Glassford. Okay.
I refuse. He's a huge racist.
Probably. Given the time period. Probably. Pelham Glassford, he's in favor of treating the Bonus Army reasonably, and he's like, we should not take any extreme measures. Maybe we just give them some food and some medicine and help them out. But President Hoover, he's not as Pacific-minded, and Hoover's Secretary of War, this guy Patrick Hurley, is in his ears about a potential Bolshevik revolution if these Bonus Army troops are camping out and demanding, and FDR's ascending. We don't know what's going to happen, right? Yeah. Let's play it safe according to our definition of what.
And crack open some skulls.
And
big
crack
dog.
Some skulls, man. There we go. So July 28th, 1932, Hoover orders Hurley, Secretary of War, to order General Douglas MacArthur. I didn't know this. To disperse the crowd with troops from the 3rd Cavalry Regiment. And Eisenhower is there, and so is General Patton. And they're like breaking up the crowd with batons. They probably aren't on the front lines doing this stuff. They're commanding the guys who are.
Yeah.
Like tear gas is thrown. They're burning
Patton
down.
Maybe.
Patton may be.
Patton may be. And they just.
I don't know. I don't.
You gotta give them hell, boys.
like this.
Homeless vets.
Their form's all wrong. You gotta crack them like this. You know.
Oh man.
Getting into
look
it.
Look up Patton quotes.
I'm ready to hear him. I'm down to hear him.
1970 Patton is a great film. It is. It's a lot.
I haven't seen it.
You got it. It's on the list. It's on the list.
Right, it's along with Guns of August. Guns okay. of August? No, that's a different one. August? What's the World War One one?
Oh, I don't know. That's
Whispers of the Autumnal Summer? No, that's not
okay.
right.
Okay, you know move on with the FDR anyway, thing.
Tear gas at burning shelters, and the event gets national coverage. FDR's pretty sure that after this one, this loss of face for the Republican Party is going to almost like guarantee him the presidential election. And, you know, you try not to isolate causes when talking about historical causality, but this is a pretty big, thing that helps him out, you know?
Yeah. It's, just like George Patton. I just got to put up a quote from Patton.
Okay, right on.
he's just in the middle of this crowd, just beating homeless vets with a baton, just like, the object of war is not to die for your country, but to other make the other bastard die for his. But you should have died in goddamn trenches.
You need to chill. You need to chill, Pat.
Yeah,
I don't know what happened. You need to relax.
That's why he's made a great general in World War II.
I think so. He had that bloodthirsty streak, right?
Yeah, bloodthirsty is apt.
Yeah. The story breaks about the attack on the bonus army, and what I didn't know, FDR calls MacArthur a potential Mussolini. I thought was interesting. That's the vibes that FDR's getting, is like, this MacArthur guy is a man to be watched. I don't know if I trust him entirely, which is interesting.
Yeah,
you know?
Really good. Really good. Really perceptive stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're really peeking into the future there.
Yeah.
At MacArthur's little, that little moment he had in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, like late 40s, early 50s. All the beef he would give a spry Harry Truman, right?
Yeah.
Not so spry. Yeah. Spry relatively, right? I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, not really. He's fucking old.
He's pretty old at that point.
They're all old.
But not as old as he would be, right?
Yeah.
This gets us into Act 2, Navigating the Rapids. So Election Day, 1932, FDR wins by 7 million votes. Popular votes. He gets 22 million to Hoover's 15 million, but like a fucking whopper of a win in the Electoral College, 427 electoral delegates. Like, that's immense. And in his conversation, or in private conversation, FDR agrees with the Stimson Doctrine. Henry L. Stimson, I believe, was his Secretary of War. It was at least in his cabinet, if not Secretary. I think, I'm pretty sure Secretary of War. Stimson Doctrine states, it does not support the fruits of any military aggression, and they're announcing this specifically in regard to Japan and Manchuria and northwestern China and Japanese aggression in the region generally.
Yeah.
February of 1933, Governor William Comstock of Michigan declares an 8-day bank holiday, and he freezes the funds of nearly a million people, 900,000. The same thing occurs in Baltimore, and so there's this panic. There's like a flight of gold and specie into Europe, and people are like withdrawing from the stock market. And in response to this, because FDR's not president yet, right? So it's a lame duck session, but Hoover refuses to take any action to stop the capital flight. Like, he could have announced a national bank holiday until the panic was over and cooler heads prevailed. He could have embargoed gold shipments abroad, but Hoover's whole kind of rationalization for why he didn't do anything is that, I guess, he's like a strict constitutionalist.
Yeah.
And there's the idea that this would be overstepping federal authority. And the funny thing about like strict constitutionalist, what I think is funny about it, is it's one of these like ways that you can be sacrosanct and self-aggrandizing and get away with saying something like, well, at least I did nothing. You know what I mean? At least I didn't overstep the cause. At least I didn't take any action. At least I did that. At least I did nothing. And it's like, okay,
it's like
great, you know?
Yeah, it's like, all right, dog, we were starving, fam.
But at least you didn't overstep federal authority, according to what was written down by our founders, right? That's the romanticism is more important than action, right? Okay, asshole. Sure.
All right, he was active out here.
I'm getting hot takes, man. I'm fucking sick of this shit. All right,
get him out.
Do something, you know. March 4th of 1930. This is when 1933. FDR sworn in his inaugural address, he gives probably the most famous quote that he's ever delivered. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. So he's already signaling this, at least I did nothing philosophy. I'm not about it. I'm going to fucking... I'm going to wipe my ass with this Constitution. Yeah, all right.
I'm gonna poke a lot of holes, ask a lot of questions.
Uh-huh. And it's going to work for the most part.
And then I'm just going to do a lot of stuff.
Now I'm going to do a lot. I'm going to try. Like he said in his fucking acceptance speech for nomination, he was like, just try some shit. And if it doesn't work, admit you failed and try something else. You know, it's not that hard. It's not that hard. Yeah. Nobody wants to fail anymore. That's the problem. Sometimes it's like, all right, well, it didn't work. You know, sometimes you fuck up.
I fail nightly.
Nightly, yeah, daily, nightly. I fail in my dreams. Yeah, man.
I failed a lot of places, and I keep trying.
Keep trying.
And I keep crying too.
You should record your sobs and put it on your SoundCloud, man. Maybe there's.
Who says I didn't, big dog? Who says I haven't?
I mean, I wouldn't know. You didn't drop it. All right, come on, man.
It's been dropped. I got a small following. By small, I mean small. Okay.
Small, I mean my cousins.
Man, I mean very primary. Small. Yeah, I wish they listened. Wish my cousins would listen to my number.
Same month, March 1930, as President, FDR calls back Congress for a special session and declares a national bank holiday for 4 days. And he does what Hoover could have done, which is embargo gold and silver shipments and prevent the foreign exchange of currency, moreover. So just trying to like stabilize the economic situation and prevent more capital from leaving the economy.
Yeah.
And then throughout the year, next thing on his docket is to balance the budget. He slashes all government workers' salary by 15%. And also cuts benefits to World War I veterans, which ate up like 25% of the budget. So you have some top-down austerity. You know, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to preach austerity, you have to lead with the right foot. And that is like, all right, all government employees are taking pay cuts, right? That's what you mean, austerity?
I don't agree. With any
you don't agree?
Let's continue. No, okay. I don't. No. We won't talk about this.
I know I don't know how much they get paid now, but at least like... Thomas Sankara did the same thing where he announced austerity and he was like, yeah, austerity on part of the government. And he's like, we're going to slash salaries and I'm going to sell off this private fucking fleet of limousines that we have for the president because I'm not that guy.
Yeah, of course, the limousines, dog. Of course, they got to go, fam. Nobody like these. Sees the limousines like, yo, that's the president. Mm-hmm. Or yo, that's the senator. That's the senator. Nobody needs that. No, we don't need that. The president needs that because he needs to be bulletproof because he's trying to kill him all day.
Sankara was on the bike, though. FDR wasn't on the bike, but then again, he had polio. So maybe he might have been if he did. I don't really know.
Look.
It's all counterfactual, right?
Okay. All right.
Another thing he does, he has the agrarian bill. Farmers would be paid not to generate agricultural surpluses, which was what was depressing prices for their crops in the first place. Part of what it was. He consolidates credit lines for farmers through the Farm Credit Administration and refinances a bunch of their mortgages to prevent foreclosures. He also like slowed the rate at which they paid their mortgages. I think it's called amortization. Mm-hmm. I just learned that word where you like slow the shit down. That way they can meet these smaller, there's more payments, but they're over a longer period of time. And they're smaller, and so it prevents you from, you're at least proving your credit, right? And saying, like, no, I can make these smaller payments that I can eventually pay this off. You don't need to foreclose, which every time there's a foreclosure, there's economic instability in a manner of speaking.
It's a knock-on effect. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help the community.
No, things of course not.
It does help motherfuckers on Wall Street who's trying to flip that hoe and trying to buy high stuff cheap.
It helps the few at the expense of the many. Yeah.
Yeah. He's trying to make that flip.
Yeah,
a man's, what's the Steve, what is the dude's name? From the last administration, Steve? Steve Munchin? What's
Steve
Munchin?
Bannon?
No, the other one. Yeah, I don't know. We'll move
the
on. Other,
the deep Steve. I don't know. I just know the surface Steve.
A lot of Steve in that game, big dog.
FDR goes on to ask for $500 million in federal funds to for unemployment relief. He regulates the securities markets, all these Wall Street dudes who are, you know, doing these flips and exchanging securities and whatnot. And he's like, all right, we're gonna put you under a little bit more scrutiny. I don't know what it does specifically. Yeah, there's mortgage relief going on and the establishment of the Tennessee Valley Authority, one of their first big public works projects, is a giant hydro, or they like improve, revamp, what's the word? Invest, you know what I mean? They build it back up. There was this hydroelectric dam at Muscle Shoals that like made a bunch of ammunition for World War One, and they go ahead, but it needs repairs and stuff, and so they just repair it and get it back operational and everything, and as well as like railroad rehabilitation, everything. There's also the Civilian Conservation Corps, which is planting trees, building bridges, digging reservoirs. It employed nearly 3 million young men by 1939, and the government foots the bill for all of the food and the housing and whatnot. The men are paid $1 a day, and they work in these camps like run by the army. And you know, there are some instances where they're just like planting trees all day, and there's a way that they're like, the government's paying these wages to private citizens, and then private citizens are paying the wages to, you know, taverns, hotels, maybe saving up enough money and buying a car or whatnot. And so it's a way to kind of like, it's the way trickle down economics should be, almost. Or you know what I'm saying?
It's a
form of trickle down economics that was effective.
Trickle up. I mean, you just didn't trickle up because it's not really down.
Well, it's coming like, down from the government, I guess is what I'm saying. And then it's like going planting into the citizens, and then the citizens are paying it back up to whomever, or maybe not even back this up, back like keeping it within the class, within the lower and middle class, you know?
Yeah, but they're like a seed, and like if you're planting a seed and the seed sprouts up rather than
I see.
You're trickle downing, but it's like pushing. Yeah. You're like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
pushed up.
Yeah, it's there's an economic fluidity here, which is I guess the important thing is that
It's weird. It's weird that these slash the kind of like budgets, like the salaries, but then like all of this stuff, like the WPA, the Conservation Corps, all these civil works type stuff, are just like he's just basically creating jobs. Mm-hmm. It's like the way you like get out of an actual like recession is you just hire a bunch of government workers, and then they become, you know, unemployed people become government workers. And like rides it out until like the rest of the economy rebounds. So my understanding, but that's what he does here. He just fucking everybody's get. He takes unemployed and just gives them jobs.
Yeah,
doing shit like it's still to this day. Like most of our like you go out to like those small Texas towns and they have like town squares and they have like town squares that say this is the town, what the park is, all that stuff. That stuff is still shit that was done by this
FDR.
By FDR. Like we have not touched it since.
No.
Like
man, there's the last thing I saw is I was in San Antonio walking not like the touristy part of the Riverwalk, because we admittedly we were trying to get there. We just were walking the other direction. Yeah. But there
now
are
you
some
got a cheap hotel. I know the vibe. The hotel's a little bit away.
And we were walking and there's like something along the, I don't know if it's the north side, just the non-commercial part of the Riverwalk that's like built by the, it's either WPA or PWA. It's like, you can see this shit. So a lot of our infrastructure that is still standing originates from this period, you know? It's incredible. What you can do when you harness the power of government and put it to good work, when you have strong leadership, you know what I mean?
It's so stupid.
Okay. I mean, you don't want to say it's that easy, but also,
yeah.
Come on. Try something. He also has the Civil Works Administration, which employs people to build roads and bridges and schools and recreation areas, and it's only around until April of 1934, but by, I think, the time that it is liquidated or terminated, it had pumped $1 billion into the economy, 80% of that through workers' wages.
Nice.
And I guess the thing that I was trying to say with trickle down is that it's not coming from private entities. It's coming from a public entity. It's coming from the government, you know? And so that's why it kind of, it works better if it comes from the government than it does from private industries. Because the whole Reagan trickle down was like trusting private companies to do that themselves. And they were like, nah, I'm just going to fucking store this in a Swiss account or in the Cook Islands somewhere, you know?
All libertarian viewers, listeners, I know y'all exist. Close your ears right now. We'll just have another 30 seconds and then we'll get back to it. No, that's the whole thing about when you give rich people money.
Yep.
They can do whatever the fuck they want to do with it. And guess what? The market doesn't say invest in my business right now.
No.
So I'm not going to invest in it, bro.
I'm not going to do anything.
I'm just going to spend money because you said spend money.
There's no who says I have to do this? You're trusting me to do this? Why would you trust me? That's crazy.
I mean, look, if the market conditions called for it, well, I was like, I can get something, but like half the time, people are like, I'll be able to get that cheaper. People are like, I'll just pay this back to my stockholders and increase my bonus.
Why take a risk if you don't have to?
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
So January of 1934, Congress, with a little bit of nudging and encouragement from FDR, establishes the Security and Exchange Commission to regulate investments and the Federal Communications Commission to regulate the airways, because like he's coming into power at the same time as radio generally. And so, but you know, I didn't know this, or, you know, I always hear about the SEC and the FCC and stuff. I didn't know that they originated with FDR.
Yeah.
1935, FDR is working on passing Social Security, and it's not perfect. It's another, like, government program that is still around today. He wanted to cover people. You said this in the last episode about Leroy Jones, and I did look into it today. Yeah. He wanted to cover people who were regularly employed in commerce and industry. It didn't cover a lot of people, like, initially.
You go through those negotiations with, like, him and, like, the Southern senators, and, like, there's just certain things that, like, there's certain specific industries or roles or positions that, like, it just didn't cover. And those, like, it's particularly, you're talking about, like, you know, like, porters or, like, people who were in the service industries. And these are things that were, like, heavily black in the South.
That's the thing that I wanted to mention, because I read this one, like, essay today by this guy Larry DeWitt, who's a public historian with the Office of Publications and Logistics Management in the Social Security Administration, and he was saying that the racial issues and like when this got promulgated historically was in like the late 90s, early 2000s. And that the conversation in the 30s around like racial issues and you know, the negotiation of the New Deal with Southern Democrats, it had to do with the Social Security program is Title II of like an 11 title bill. Mm-hmm. And the pushback and sort of the negotiation with these racist Southern Democrats had to do with Title I, not necessarily Title II. There wasn't, it's DeWitt's contention that there wasn't any deliberate exclusion as a result of race. It had to do more with like tax issues.
I've listened to different things that have said that there was more of a racial thing. I can't pull up an exact essay because you ambushed me on my own goddamn podcast, you son of a bitch.
You mentioned it and I wanted to look into it. And I mean, FDR's civil rights record is by no means good. Let me say that as well. Like, he's very lacking on this, but not so much in Social Security, I think.
I would argue differently, but, you know, I don't have a fucking, I don't have, you know, let's, I'm gonna argue differently.
Okay, right on.
Yeah.
April 8th of 1935, Congress provides FDR with a $4.8 billion appropriation to spend as he saw fit. He gives most of it to Harry Hopkins and the newly established, very shiny, Works Progress Administration. They employ 3 million people in the first year. Over an eight-year period, employed 8.5 million people and pumped $11 million into the economy, improving infrastructure and like just creating it generally, inventing new infrastructure, while also subsidizing like writers and artists. And there are like there are plays or theatrical companies who were also subsidized to put on productions and shit. So basically any just modern modern Republican nightmare of like, you're giving money to the arts, you're giving government dollars
to theater,
come on.
Oh yeah, no, that's how, that's again, I'll talk about the fucking things in like Texas, like the little small towns and shit. Like a lot of those granite pieces, they're done by artists because they mm-hmm. need to employ people. They mm-hmm. need to employ artists also, mm-hmm. so they employed them mm-hmm. and not just use them to do shit. It's not that hard, dog.
I like to think it's not that hard. It was easy then because he's also working during this period with a oh man, the parallels, the lack of parallels, I should say, between when you have a fucking majority in Congress, a Democratic majority in Congress, and a Democrat in the White House. You should be able to get shit done like this, but
yeah.
You know,
no, I mean,
there was a time when you could. I can say that, right?
Yeah, I mean,
when you could,
there were times. Yeah, there were times.
There was also the Rural Electrification Act and the Wagner Labor Relations Act. The former is responsible for bringing electricity to areas that needed it, such as Meriwether County, home of Warm Springs. So he's listened to the people and is delivering on. Maybe not his promise, but he's listened to them, he's heard them, and he's meeting their demands with like roads and electricity, because it's going to help the farmers, it's going to help the common man, you know?
Yeah. No.
There are also nonprofit rural cooperatives subsidized by like long-term, low-interest government loans, I believe, as part of the Rural Electrification Act, if not the Wagner Labor Relations Act. I know the Wagner Labor Relations Act specifically, it guarantees labor the power to bargain and collectivize, organize collectively. FDR signs it into law in July of 1935. And I think, like, contrary to popular belief, there was some, like, FDR wasn't initially in favor of that, so I don't want to portray him excessively as he flips on it eventually and he's like, no, this is a good idea, we should work on this, but initially he wasn't altogether pro labor, and I don't want to make it that like seem like that was the case, you know?
Yeah, no, he wasn't, as you could tell from like the previous episode, right? He's had changing views, right? Mm-hmm. But he's really good at recognizing where his power base can come from.
Yeah.
And so he takes in labor as it, because he realized I can service their issues and we like align on issues. So
yeah,
it's not that hard just to get a power base of people that you know will support you.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to think about it in terms that are not sheerly altruistic, as it is, I suppose, to where he's aligning or he's seeing the potential to expand his power base while also adhering to more utilitarian ideals and saying, oh, this is going to help more people, while also saying, like, it's also going to help me. You know, and so it's like, you know, it's wrong. I think it's wrong, or at least it's not.
I mean,
I'm saying it's wrong to think of politics or a lot of things in terms sheerly of like, oh, is it all about the other person? It's like nothing is. These things exist as like a mutualism thing. Humans are social creatures, and you know, a tide that raises both ships is helpful to both. That shouldn't be downplayed. That's just the way it works. You know.
I just think. A lot of people do things for their own like good. Like, he's gonna always think about his own good, because he said from the jump, like, I'm gonna follow Teddy's path to power.
Yep.
So I do just good that his for me, or personally, I think it's good that his want for power aligned also with labor
yeah.
in this country.
Yeah, and it's funny to think of things in terms of Teddy Roosevelt, and I imagine some
mud power being hungry motherfucker.
Oh, for sure. But some mud being slung against him would be like, oh, you just want to bust trusts and regulate these big corporations because you want power for yourself. And it's like, yeah. Are you a fucking child? Of course he does, you know? But it's also like, but does that make this entire program inherently bad?
No.
Is it going to work for people if he does? Is it good for more people if he does? Yeah.
I don't know about the motivation.
You can't isolate. I guess I'm trying to say it's not an and or. It's more of an and. It's not an or. It is an and. That's what I'm trying to say. It's like, we shouldn't try to isolate causality. There's a lot of things that go into human behavior, especially when you get into politics.
I do not know about the motivations of Teddy.
I don't really either. I'm just saying it's like you shouldn't think of things in terms of like FDR and for that matter TR both like did these things in part because they wanted to exercise power, and it wasn't entirely self-aggrandizing, but also it did help people. So
yeah,
both can exist. Both can exist. You know,
judge the motivations of people. I will sometimes. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I don't know sometimes. so yeah.
All right. So this gets us ambivalently limping into Act 3, which I will call hubris. Speaking of January 20th. 1937, FDR is reelected. There was some stuff in 1936 I want to talk about. One of the first things that he does in 1937 with his power is he tries to pack the Supreme Court with more judges, because throughout his first term, there had been pushback from the Supreme Court, and they weren't like strictly stacked against him. It was just a couple things that the Supreme Court had shot down that earned them FDR's ire, and he started to get this idea that he should pack the courts because he thought that he had to. I just wanted to mention that it occurred, because we're going to do a whole episode, a wormhole on it next week, so I'm not going to dive into it excessively because that's just around the bend. I just want to keep moving with the the narrative here.
Yeah.
June of 1937, FDR slashes all of these social programs that he had launched, and then October 19th of that same year, the stock market has its worst day since Black Tuesday. It is being called by the Republican opposition Roosevelt's recession, and I've heard some things on this. Primarily, the Ken Burns documentary talks about the reason the recession recurred, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not because of the excessive expenditures and hyperinflation caused by federal government programs.
Yeah.
It seems to be the contention of, I don't remember his name, one of the guys on the Ken Burns documentary, that they pulled the money out too soon. They thought that they had corrected the economy. They thought they had healed the economy as best as they could.
Yeah.
And then the deficit hawks got in their ear, and they're like, all right, let's pull all this money out. And then that was preemptive, and so the economy fell back down again, even though it was just now starting to get back onto its feet. He reversed course too soon when he should have kept priming the pump, so to speak.
Yeah, no, it's you're pulling it out because you're like, it's inflated, and then once you stop pumping it up, it's not actually that much inflated.
Yeah,
it's actually pretty deflated.
Yeah, you just keep it going, juice it, you know, keep juicing it. Don't give up now. Full steam ahead, you know, wait till it can stand on its own legs. Don't, like, if you're helping somebody back to their feet and they're, you know, they can't fucking walk and they're like halfway there about to stand, but their knees are still bent. Don't let go, you know, like wait till their legs are rigid to their knees are unbent. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, yes.
Okay. Right. Yes. December 12th of 1937, there are some rumblings in China. There's the bombing of the USS Panay in the Yangtze River. It was built in 1928 to protect U.S. commercial interests. At the time, the Panay was protecting Standard Oil tankers. And there's kind of a, there's a reason why those Standard Oil tankers are there, because honestly, the U.S. is one of the people, and specifically like private oil companies, are part of the reason why the Japanese war machine was rolling through China, you know, is because there's money to be made, you know.
Look, as long as the cash is flowing, look, Standard Oil, look, Shell's not saying shit.
Nope. Like, you got Texaco in Spain funding Franco, and then you've got Standard Oil funding the Japanese imperialists.
Yeah.
And it's just
like, yeah, man.
Okay.
On, need that money, big dog. Need it.
Yeah. The Panay gets bombed, I think, because Japan mistook it for a Chinese vessel. I'm not exactly sure why. The Japanese foreign minister, Kiki Hirota, issues an apology. He says that they will reimburse the U.S. for these losses. They do so in April for about $2 million, and they fire the commander who launched the attacks, because at this time, Japan is still very afraid of U.S. involvement, and they don't want to piss off the U.S., especially because that's where they're getting their oil, you know? Don't bite the hand that feeds you, so to speak.
Of course. You can't. If you bite the hand that feeds you, guess what? Now that hand is not going to give you spoonfuls of applesauce anymore.
No more applesauce for you, man.
No more applesauce. I'm talking about something from my childhood. Just went back there right now.
Mm-hmm. And it's the cinnamon kind.
Deep into the meta brain.
That's right, man.
Deep into the meta brain where all the memories are floating around.
All the soup of the self, right? March 11th, 1938, there's another slide toward World War II when Adolf Hitler annexes Austria, and the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain supposedly thought that Hitler would be an important bulwark against communism, because he's also worried about this, so it's like, he's gonna stop the Russians, isn't he? And it's like, yeah. I don't know if you know what you're doing, man. But I mean, how could he have? Yeah. But also, come on.
My man's an elitist.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know what I mean? Still, the communist threat is like a lot more, and then like you're not as worried about the Nazis. They're just kind of weird boots, and like,
yeah.
But like, they have little mustaches, but you're not worried about them as much. But then like, because you're worried about these poors.
You're worried about these poors, man. Yeah. They're present. They're in your country, you know?
Yeah, they're in your country. Nazis are there also. Then American Nazis are the fun.
Are the also American running boom. Around doing yeah. that shit, like Charles Lindbergh and whatnot. And
yeah.
I don't remember the names of the specific organizations, but there are like mm-hmm. American Nazi groups.
Yeah.
We're just like, yeah. we're doing this. And it's like,
so sold out Madison Square Garden, fam, in the 30s.
Yes, they did. Yeah, that is correct. I wanted to mention a blemish on FDR's record. Senator Robert Wagner, I think in 1938, was trying to pass his anti-lynching legislation, which would prosecute local law enforcement for not investigating a lynching after 30 days, and it's brought up like multiple times. FDR did not take a strong stance on it. Any of these times, there's like little to no civil rights legislation passed mm-hmm. over his 12 years in office. I didn't want to just brush that under the rug, you know?
Yeah, no, the anti-lynching thing, yeah, he's playing to his southern
yeah,
the southern yeah. parts of his Democratic Party. You can't be like, this is what you do is not a federal crime.
Yeah.
Pretty
sure his VP was from Texas too.
Yeah, that's how they play it. You need to stabilize that shit with your base. You got the union members. You got all that shit up north. You're from New York. You need to fucking secure the South. So
you got the farmers. Yeah, so you kind of have the West, and you gotta get the South. May of 1938, there is the Fair Labor Standards Act, or Wages and Hours Bill, which sets the minimum wage. It bans child labor, gives 45-hour work week and time and a half for overtime. And then September 29th of 1938, there is the Four Power Agreement in Munich between Great Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. Hitler vows not to annex any more territory, And just, I also learned this while reading, Sudetenland is apparently 29% of Czechoslovakian territory, which I didn't know it was a fucking more than a quarter, nearly a third of their land, you know?
Yeah. It's it's a chunk, and
He's got his eyes. It's a good looking morsel. It's a good looking chunk of land. You know, it's like.
It's German, though. It's just supposedly, I guess, a German part of Czechoslovakia.
And then Churchill, I think he says this publicly, if not like in one of his letters or something. I just have this quote. He says, "The government had to choose between shame and war. They chose shame and will get war." So he knows it's coming regardless. He's like, why would you ever appease this madman? He's not your friend. Don't fall for this shit, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, people at the time, I think they were like, man, I just don't want to do World War I again.
Yeah, it was rough. It was a bad time, you know?
Those poppies at Flanders Field. People still have those memories, so they're just like, all right, I just don't want
to
do war.
I don't want to go back to that. I don't want to return to that.
They were over there like, we want to go to war now.
We think we can do it. We think we'll be okay, you know?
We think we'll do it again, fam.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Shortly after that, November 10th of 1938, you have Kristallnacht. Over 200 synagogues are burned. 7,500 shops are looted, and then there's legislation passed subsequently saying that Jewish people are barred from attending schools and universities. They can't go to concerts and theaters. They couldn't even drive. Things are looking bad, right?
Yeah. So I'm just gonna say this because I think it's pronounced Kristallnacht.
Kristallnacht.
Kristallnacht, which does sound like the champagne that P. Diddy used to drink in 2004. Kristallnacht, not Kristallnacht. It's not about to pop bottles when you say Kristallnacht.
Of course, no. No.
You have to pop bottles. Okay, I don't want to do this joke. Let's move on.
November 15th of 1938, at a press conference, FDR is asked about the resettlement of Jewish refugees. FDR says, that is not in contemplation. We have the quota system. And America is still like strongly isolationist. I think there was like around 5% of the American public was in favor of raising the quotas. And there is like, I watched a PBS documentary. I don't remember the name of it, that basically outlines what America's policy towards Jewish resettlement was in like the late 30s and early 40s, and how we knew earlier than is claimed in public. I don't know how to really navigate that or disaggregate that, I'm going to be honest.
It's like they knew by 43. They knew that it was like bad. They knew that it was like bad.
Yeah.
I mean, the quota system is like racist.
Yeah.
It's incredibly racist because it just wants like, it's like asking for the quotas that it has for certain groups of people are larger if you're from Western European looking nations rather than if you're from anywhere else or you have a certain religion. Like it's the quota system is racist. It's a lot of our immigration stuff. It's been racist, they just didn't let them in because they were also anti-Semitic.
Yeah,
to a certain extent.
To a certain extent.
So,
I know like one of the main guys to start lobbying for change in regards to these policies is the Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau because he was Jewish as well. So he kind of. Is resonates with him.
I think it's that whole story. There's a whole story about that ship of I think of Jewish people who had I think it went to New York and they wouldn't let them in
and went to Cuba.
Havana,
and they turned him away as well.
Uh-huh. And then they headed right back to Germany. And I forgot the number, but I'm pretty sure.
I have it in one of my briefs, but I don't remember the name. I think it was like 1,200 refugees. That sounds that sounds right. But check me on that. I know what FDR does do, what John Edward Smith, what his biography mentions FDR does, is he expedites the passports of Jewish people so they can get into the U.S. He combined the German and Austrian immigration quotas, and he also extended the passports and visas of Germans and Austrians already in the U.S. on visitations. And around this time, he also starts selling planes to France via the Treasury Department, because there's kind of a loophole, because it's, you know, through the, if you're selling this equipment through the Treasury Department, it's considered a foreign arms sale. And so, like, the War Department can't really touch it, or Congress can't. Nobody else can touch it. It's just a way that they can get around the red tape. It bypasses opposition, and they're all able of to these start things, funneling shit to France, you know?
Yeah, all of, like, if people tell you they can't do something in government, it's usually just that they don't want to break a norm.
Yeah.
It's not that they can't find a way to do it. They actually could, but they don't want to break the norm and be seen as, like, somebody's like a, he's just fucking doing whatever.
Yeah, he's usurping federal authority. You know, he's supposed to do nothing, damn it, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole thing that we've got going here. And it's like, okay, and, cool.
And certain people break the norms, and then they just keep doing it, and then nobody stops them. That's a whole different thing.
And then they become tyrants. So there is precedent, but also, you know.
Or they just become Mitch McConnell. But that's a whole different thing.
There's January of as far as the sales to the French, I didn't know about this. January of 1939, there's a Douglas A-20 bomber which crashes in California with a French purchasing agent inside, and there's like a huge public shitstorm. FDR invites members of the Senate Military Affairs Committee to a press conference on the 27th, where he says, in reference to the war, or the oncoming of the war, just the situation in Europe at this time, says, I cannot overemphasize the seriousness of the situation. So he understands where shit's headed, and he is trying to get the Senate, Congress, and just the public generally to recognize that what just because it's happening overseas doesn't mean that there isn't a threat, an active threat to the nation. Maybe we should pay more attention to this.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, look, it's the horrors of World War One. Nobody wants to be involved in this shit.
I get it.
This World War One changed the world. It was the last. It was the last war people went off singing to.
Yeah.
The last one they marched off singing, and when they came back, they were not singing.
No joy.
It changed art. It changed. I was just thinking about this today. We still have the term trenches in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that when you reference, oh, I'm in the trenches. I'm the
down in the trenches, and it's like,
you don't want to be in. It's a harsh place. It's a place you eventually will leave. You have to leave.
Yeah.
It's just in our vocabulary. That's the thing that war was.
But also, and not to excessively romanticize, but the bonds of camaraderie established in the trenches as well.
No. Absolutely not.
Because you're dying with your brother. You're going through some shit with your brothers, man.
I'm saying what that dude said in Stalag 17. Look, when I get out of here and I see you fucks on the street, let's just do each other a favor and let's make like we never met.
Okay. All right. like c'est la vie.
Yeah,
right?
You know what I mean? yeah.
So in March 15th of 1939, Hitler violates the Four Power Agreement by annexing the rest of Czechoslovakia, and this is commonly regarded as the outbreak of World War II, and that is where we're going to end our second episode on FDR. World War II has commenced in Europe, however, America's heavily isolationist. FDR recognizes the seriousness of the situation and the need to get involved, but he has to find a way to accomplish both ends. He has to find a way to keep the hearts and minds of the public, because they're on his side, but there's this big mine that he could step on and thus lose election in 1940. So he's got to walk this tightrope, man, and we're going to see how he does it. 2 weeks from 2 weeks hence, actually, because next week, Wormhole on Court Packing, and then right after that, we're going to talk FDR Part 3, where we hit World War II.
And then we find out how FDR planned Pearl Harbor
Clown boy has the fucking sensibilities of a 19-year-old edgelord. Okay, let me say
who
that.
Who are you talking about?
Myself. This was like one of the first jokes that I wrote. Is like, oh, Pearl Harbor was the first inside job. Like, okay, oh, you fucking God. Child.
Jesus
you
Christ.
Child.
I'm glad I didn't see that part of your set while I first met you, because we met.
I never told that one because I figured it would.
Yeah, please. Don't.
I was like, it's not going to do well. Nobody's going to.
First
know
of all, it's a history joke.
About.
Nobody gets it.
That's what I'm saying. But, you know, he's a little late. I don't want to say he poached it from me, because I would never. I'm saying it in jest. He's saying it in.
Who's Clown fucking Boy? Edgelord. Who's the Clown Boy?
Alex
Are
Jones.
You still the Clown Boy?
I
oh, you're talking about Alex Jones. Oh, yes. Okay.
I hope I'm not Clown Boy. Come on, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
You gotta say it like this.
No, you gotta say it like this.
You gotta say it like if you're
Okay, man. Guys, thank you for listening. We love you. You guys can follow. Actually, you already know where you can follow us. You've mm-hmm. seen it. You heard it at the first part. Go back to the first part.
Mm-hmm.
Follow us at all those places.
What you doing lately? You got something? You got anything?
Shows. You have shows?
I don't have anything. I have yet to be on.
We have a show together.
Do we?
Where we're opening from Gareth from the dollop.
Are we?
Yeah, dog.
I'm unsure on this.
Are you not? You're on the thing. We're on the thing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
all right.
Okay.
We're open. All right. Oh, I'll check this before I edit this. All right. We're opening for Gareth or the Dollop. That's going to be soon. We'll put the
August. We'll put the event I think it's August 16th.
On all social media.
I believe. Yeah. We'll share that shit.
August 6th? Okay.
16th,
yeah. August
6th. I think.
August 16th.
But we'll update that if.
Yeah. We'll update you on that.
Okay. Cool.
What do you have any other shows?
No, I ain't got shit, man.
Why'd you recommend that we do shows and they'll just be me doing shows?
I'm laying low for now. Okay.
All right. All right. Just now you can know where I'll be at mm-hmm, alone. Mm-hmm, fine. Mm-hmm, that's great. Mm-hmm. I have shows. I don't know. Follow me on social media for my show. I need to have them prepared up here. All right. Every Sunday, Eighth Wonder.
That's
comedy
right.
showcase.
That's right.
Every Thursday, Back of the Bus comedy open mic. Guys, you know that's where you can find me. I love you. Henry loves you. He just doesn't say it. See you next time.
That's right.
Okay.